As I said yesterday, one of the things that Dr. Lathrop and I hope to do in our presentations is to sort of stimulate your thinking and kind of get you back into a certain mode of contemplating these matters, and so that the rather generous time we have for questions and answers and so forth, we can get into all kinds of things. And the sort of pastoral liturgy agenda of our time together, we have come to the conclusion might be better done in that sort of Q&A thing. As I said, rather than trying to figure out what you think you might want to know and trying to address ourselves to that mystery. But rather trying to get the wheels going, try to get some things that in some cases you already know, in many cases you know well, but sort of get those juices flowing again so that in our time for exchange, when both of us are up here. The other thing, Gordon and I have known each other a long time. And we will agree on some things, we will disagree on some things, and we love each other anyway. We really have enormous love and respect for each other, and we've done this a lot. So when we start kibitzing up here, there's no reason for you to be nervous. There may be reason for us to be nervous, but not for, no, seriously. We're not unfamiliar with one another's foibles. And I've got some great stories to tell you about Gordon. I'm much better armed at stories about him than he is about me. So we got this figured out. And so this morning what I want to do is give you a little tour of kind of how we got to where we are. And it will emphasize the Anglican side slightly, but it will bring in a fair amount of the Lutheran material as well, especially at some critical points where their convergence takes place, it seems to me. And then one of the places toward which this is going is to talk a little bit about how the difference in the two books, how the difference in the Book of Common Prayer for the Episcopalians and ELW for the Lutherans, how those books have a different life in our respective churches. And Gordon will also address that as well, and maybe we'll even engage in some conversation about that. We already had a wonderful conversation about it this morning at my table at breakfast, about how the two churches have this deep respect for their books, but they live in relationship to their heart and soul slightly differently. But my own view is that one of the great gifts of our full communion and our life together is in many cases these are not the Anglican way, the Lutheran way, and treating those as different as they may be on some items, treating them somehow as though they are mutually exclusive, and places where we are pushing against each other. I rather think of wallowing in the ambiguity of it all. You know, one of my teachers, Aidan Cavanaugh, used to say, "It's the poverty of precision that is killing us sometimes," which was one of his ways of pleading that some things. Need some things in the life of faith, thereby in the liturgy, need to remain rich and ambiguous and full and overflowing, and we just might kill it if we over-explain it. One ought never to speak of their own preaching, but one of my own sermons that I, if you ask me, what's the best sermon you ever preached? Well, I have no idea, but. But one of the ones I remember was a sermon when I came clean on Maundy Thursday about the fact that Holy Week was a much deeper, richer experience for me when I knew less about it. And being a person who works most of his scholarly time, what little I have in these days, in the liturgical year and history of the liturgical year and all that sort of stuff, that makes Holy Week really hard. I said, I've had to work really hard in my prayer leading into Holy Week to let some of that go so I can actually enter into the rites, almost as a novice, which is very hard. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We'll see how this goes. First I want to talk about some of the common themes. All right. Come on, computer. There we go. I would argue, and this is a place where we could legitimately have some slightly different opinions, perhaps. But I would like to argue that in the 16th century, when both of our traditions were born out of the Latin Rite, the Western Rite, the Roman Church, that the liturgy was not the first problem. A lot of stuff had to be worked out liturgically, both for Lutherans on the continent and for us in, across the channel there. And a lot of the Reformation conversations had profound impact on how we prayed and how we worshiped and so forth, and what modes we were going to do that in and so forth. And yet, Reformation did not come to a head over the liturgy. And I would also go a little further and say that the two traditions represented here are traditions that took... where is it? A more conservative, or perhaps better use of the term, conserving posture toward liturgical reform. Whereas some of the folks around us were, we might say, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or were doing much more radical revisions. You know, the question for us was, all right, how do we maintain the Catholic faith while at the same time thinking about what the evangelical promise and the evangelical agenda, how do we hold those in tension and work those out in the liturgies of the church and in the church's prayer and so forth. But we, in most cases, we're not just throwing it all out and starting over. It really was thinking about maintaining some semblance of what we had inherited. You know, there's that wonderful passage in Luther where he's going up against the Zwinglians, as he often did. And one of the points that he makes there is that, you know, we can be as critical and of Mother Church as we want to be, and we can spend all our time listing all of Mother Church's faults, etc. But we must never forget that Mother Church delivered us into the bosom of Christ and gave us the gospel. With all the other stuff that may have been a problem, we still grew up in the faith. So I think another commonality there. I think in our traditions, particularly sacraments of the gospel, baptism, and Eucharist, remain core to our identity. Now, I say that in a normative sense. I believe that Lutherans and Episcopalians, Lutherans and Anglicans would agree that our core sacramental identity is focused, not limited to necessarily, but focused in baptism and the Eucharist. And we would certainly say that in a normative theological way, even if at some points in our history the normal practice has not lived those rites in their fullness. There's a difference. You know, I think we always need to keep in mind, you know, between what is normative in our theology, what is normative in our liturgical rites, what is normative in our practice, and what might in some times and places be normal in terms of pastoral practice. Okay? And that distinction is often a helpful one to remind ourselves of that. And I would argue, at least, that for both of our traditions, the sacraments of the gospel have remained normative, that they're part of what defines us. And yet there have been times when baptisms have been rather perfunctory, private baptisms, Saturday mornings in the dark corner of the church, and not a public rite of living into the Paschal mystery, passing through the death and resurrection of Jesus, enacting our public business of our witness to the resurrection. And our Eucharistic feasting has been minimalist or infrequent whatever in various times and places. But even when the living out of the ritual life was fairly minimalist and infrequent, theologically, normatively, we still would have probably said that the sacraments of the gospel are close to the heart of who we are. And then these things were augmented, of course, by daily prayer and by pastoral rites. One of the gifts, I believe, let me say just a little bit about pastoral rites. One of the gifts of the traditions represented here is that while our pastoral care is by no means limited, I do think that sacramental pastoral care, ritualized pastoral care at some appropriate level, is one of the gifts of the traditions that we bring. We're not the only traditions that do that. Obviously, the Romans do. Obviously, there are others as well. And I believe there's some evidence to show now that some of our United Methodist Presbyterians and others are beginning to think a little bit more deeply about what sacramental or ritualized pastoral care might look like. And as I say, that's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the source and summit of all of our pastoral care. We also do other things. But to come, whether it's into a sick room or into another kind of environment where pastoral care is needed, and recognize that one has the gift of remembering one's baptism, that one has Eucharistic ministry, one has the ministry of anointing, one has the ministry of confession and absolution at a time in a person's life. We heard that powerfully witnessed to last night in Bishop Monty's homily. That these are particular gifts of our tradition. I can remember personal story about that. I remember one time I was called to the hospital because a child was being born, and the likelihood was the child would either be stillborn or would live only minutes, perhaps. And so I got to the hospital, and you've all been there in those moments where you wouldn't, where the perfection of your sacramental ministrations are less important than the care of the people who are before you, right? And so I was actually standing there, and I was holding the child who was in fact dead. And I'm not a Mormon. I don't believe in the baptism of the dead or anything like that. But you know, I was struggling for some way to more tangibly, more ritually, to connect the memory of this moment with all these other things. And I was searching for something, and so I said something to the father of the little boy, and he said, you know, there may be some urge to baptize Charlie. That's the name they'd given him. There may be some urge to baptize Charlie, but we don't need to do that. Because baptism, he said to me. Now remember, I'm the priest, I'm the pastor there. You know, he said, baptism is for this life. Charlie doesn't have a this life. So Charlie doesn't need the grace of God to wallow in. He's already a recipient of the love and grace of God. And I thought, I don't know who your confirmation teacher was. But boy, she was good, you know? I was just so proud of him. I just wanted, it was great. Anyway. All right. Let me talk a little bit about the classical shape of the prayer book. For those, I want to say something about the title first. The Book of Common Prayer. We talk about the Book of Common Prayer, but the whole title of the book is The Book of Common Prayer and the Administration of the Sacraments and Other Rites and Ceremonies of the Church together with the Psalter of the Church, and Psalter of, or Psalms of David. Okay, Book of Common Prayer actually refers originally to the daily office, to the common prayer of the people of God, morning, night, every day, Sunday, feast days, every day of your life. The people are holding their prayer in common. But if you're going to have an ecclesiastical book, it's got to have what? It's got to have the administration of the sacraments, so there's got to be a service of baptism, there's got to be a service of Holy Eucharist. And then we said, well, you know, people die, so we've got to have a funeral service. Well, people get married, not in that order. And there needs to be a marriage service. Probably need something for the birth of adoption of a child. And so there are a whole variety of pastoral rites that might be needed. But Book of Common Prayer first refers to the daily prayer of the church. And bound with it are the principal sacramental rites of the church. And this actually works itself out in the history of the prayer book tradition in five sections. Part one is, of course, the daily office, the calendar of the church year, the collects of the church year, and the proper liturgies of special days, as that section is expressed in the current edition, current American edition. The second part, part two, is the administration of the sacraments, baptism, and the Holy Eucharist. And that comes in different forms. This is a good time to introduce an interesting kind of anomaly this particular. In the 16th century, as we began to work out liturgical reform, the reform tradition, you will remember, took the approach of what we would call a directory of worship, which is to say, first you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. And while there may have been prayers and liturgical texts and litanies and so forth, exactly which one you used on a particular day often was not specified. What was specified is you begin the service with the, you know, acclamation of the Trinity and a prayer of confession, and then you did the next thing, and then you had a reading, and then you had a sermon, and then you had a whatever, you know, and various directories did this differently. Well, if you look in the prayer book, this is one of the impurities of this prayer book. I say that jovially, of course. But what this prayer book, unlike every prayer book that went before it, has done is introduced directories into each of the major sections. So there are fully written out, full text rites, which is the prayer book tradition. A typical liturgical book has, you know. But what we have done here, for example, on page 400, just to pick the Eucharistic one, there's one for burial, there's one for marriage. And this is essentially a directory. The order for celebrating this rite requires careful preparation by the priests or other participants, not intended for use at the principal Sunday or weekly celebration of the Eucharist, which is to say you can't do this directory thing. The point of the prayer book there is Episcopalians and congregations ought to be able to come to their parishes on Sunday morning and in some way or another pray the prayers of the church. Pray the liturgy of the church in some relatively straightforward fashion. Okay, but we've inserted this directory idea, and I think it's an open debate, frankly, in the church whether this has been a good idea. I think it gets most use, frankly, around marriage and burial, where the prayer book materials are essentially used rather fully, but by putting those materials together under an order, under a directory, it gives the priest a little bit more freedom to be responsive to a particular kind of situation. How often it's used in particular times and places would vary widely in the church, but that's my sense that's, you know. And then, of course, you know, the order for worship often gets called Rite 3. There's nothing in the prayer book that ever calls it that. But basically, that's just sort of, you know, in-house nomenclature to say that a lot of Sunday night services that might have a lot of parishes do things that they call Celtic liturgies, and they're no more Celtic than I am Arabic, but they hum a lot or something, so therefore they're Celtic, yeah, right, or there's a lot of prayers about nature, you know. So that makes them Celtic, but anyway, a more informal Sunday night service, golfer's mass, I sometimes refer to it, and they use the order and they say, well, this is legitimate, and of course they get by the rubric because it's the Sunday night service and the principal service of the Lord's Day was that morning. Won't belabor that too much, but just keep moving here. Pastoral offices are the third part. And that's all the stuff like, you know, celebration, blessing of a marriage, blessing of a civil marriage, the order, the directory for marriage, thanksgiving, birth of adoption of a child, all of those kinds of materials. The pastoral offices. Now, one little anomaly, just to note, I'm not going to make a lot about this. I just want to file it by title. Notice where confirmation is. It's not in Episcopal services. It's in pastoral rites. I think that's enormously intentional. on the part of the framers of the prayer book, because the framers of the prayer book wanted confirmation to come out differently than it came out. They had shaped a singular service for the renewal of baptism at any time in one's life that made sense spiritually and whatever. They were dropping the distinction between confirmation, reception, and reaffirmation, and it was all going to be try to be consistent with the baptismal teaching of full initiation and so forth. And so confirmation was then thought to be a pastoral rite that may or may not involve the bishop. Of course, I'll say this to irritate all the Episcopalians in the room. We are just about the last ecclesial family that has as much carrying as much baggage as we do around confirmation and the bishop. I mean, even the Romans now, while in the sacramentary, the bishop may be the ordinary minister, may preside, the person who actually does the laying on of hands might well be a presbyter. You go to Christ the King Cathedral in Atlanta, at diocesan confirmation, the bishop is sitting in his chair, and he's presiding, and there's a line of people going to him. But Monsignor Hayes has got his line, and Monsignor so-and-so, and they're in presbyteral orders. And so, okay, well, the liturgy was presided over by a bishop, but the laying on of hands actually took place by, two-thirds of those people, somebody else, So, we're sort of the last one holding on to the end of the rope about the absolute essential nature of Episcopal confirmation. Now, I'm not arguing for it or against it one way or the other. I will say that as a bishop, it is not the principal foci of my identity. That doesn't mean I'm going to Lexington, Kentucky, because they're without a bishop. I'm doing confirmations in a couple of different places in Lexington this weekend. I'm happy to go do confirmations and receptions. There'll be joyous occasions. I love to preach. It'll be all kinds of fun. But I'd also just go preach. Okay, Episcopal services, ordination of a bishop, ordination of priests, ordination of a deacon. By the way, notice it says ordination of a bishop, not consecration. People who still refer to the consecration of bishops in the Episcopal Church do not understand the ordinal. We ordain deacons, we ordain priests, we ordain bishops. Now, I'll be glad to get into that in as much detail as you want at some point. But people who still refer to, on such and such a day our bishop was consecrated, they're either willfully using the language of earlier prayer books, which had a different understanding of holy orders, or they simply haven't realized that the church's theology of holy orders around these matters have changed. It's an interesting thing, particularly at some point perhaps to talk about with Lutherans, because the trajectory in those matters is a lot closer together than I think we might sometimes think. Yeah. Well, I think part of that was very intentional on the prayer book's part. In the Catechism, remember, it says there are four orders of ministry in Christ's Church: laypersons, bishops, priests, and deacons. And the order is intentional. That the principal order of the life of the church are lay people. Their principal servant is their bishop. Bishop has helpers. They are called priests. And priests have helpers and who serve also in relationship, and they're called deacons. In other words, and the way it's ordered there, and the way it's ordered in the prayer book, is to clarify the fact that this is not a ladder going up. It is, in fact, three separate orders, each with its own charism, each with its own responsibility, each with its own gifts in the life of the church. They do relate to one another. Now, there's still hierarchy in the canons, but there are a lot of things in the canons that are not entirely square with either the prayer book or... I won't go there. But I mean, there are places... I mean, one of the things every general convention since, you know, since 1994 has had significant resolutions trying to resolve the problem between the canons and the prayer book on conversation, on church membership, on confirmation, on who can do what, when, and where, which are canonical issues vis-a-vis the theological implications of the prayer book on that. And the other thing this I think tends to suggest is that the office of bishop is in some sense the first ministry of the church, not the end of the road. One of the debates, and it is a debate, and I can argue both sides of it. But in a particular time in our history prior to the Reformation, in the pontifical of William Durandus in the 13th century, we developed this whole notion of a sort of cumulative orders, which doesn't really exist in any meaningful sense of the word, certainly before the pontificals of the 10th century, where you begin to see a little weirdness. But in the first millennium, you don't see a lot of kind of cumulative order talk or whatever. And so then, you hit Durandus and following Durandus, and you get this whole notion about, cumulative orders. Well, the bishop cannot confer diaconal orders unless he or she has been a deacon. You can't give what you haven't got. But for the full first millennium plus of the church, we said, well, of course, the bishop can confer the diaconate if the bishop has not been a deacon. Why? Because the bishop is the bishop. It's what bishops do, confer holy orders. I mean, it's not a process of dispensing used spirit. But it's presiding over the assembly and praying with the people of God for a fresh outpouring of the Holy Spirit that this servant might be a priest or a bishop or a deacon or whatever. Anyway, that's a topic that we can get into if we need to, but I want to keep going here lest we get behind. And then the fifth part is the Psalter. Now, if you'll notice, if you'll pick up a prayer book, there are certain things that are in but not of the prayer book. And if you'll look, if you'll find your way to the end of the Psalter, Psalm 150, which is going to be about page 807 or something like that, 808. I made this point at breakfast, but if you hold the book like this, that part is the Book of Common Prayer. And all this stuff is stuff that is bound together with the prayer book for the convenience of the church, but bears not the authority of the prayer book. And so, for example, we would never quote the catechism. Now, the catechism is a wonderful teaching resource. I just quoted it a minute ago in a teaching moment, didn't I? Right. So it's a fabulous resource. We would not quote the catechism authoritatively because it is in, but not of, the prayer book. Okay? If we wanted to really know what we thought about something, we would go back and find some prayer, some liturgy, some something that gave us some clarity. But notice the confession, a bunch of prayers here, note outline of the faith, the catechism. Notice also the historical documents of the church, which for us is, you will see the Chalcedonian definition, Athanasian Creed, the preface to the first prayer book, the Articles of Religion of the Episcopal Church, not the Articles of Religion of the Church of England, and then perhaps the most important documents for us on page 876 and 77, the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral. Also, extremely important documents for our identity and who we are. And yet, note that they are bound together with the prayer book, but they are not in the prayer book. And part of the way you make that differentiation is that the prayer book is a part of the constitution of the church. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. And it takes two identical actions of the General Convention to change the first part of the book. The stuff at the back of the book can come in, can come out. We can change the lectionary at one convention, because the lectionary, like now we use the RCL, what's printed in most of these is, I notice most of these are proposed books, or at least the one I've got is a proposed book. And so the lectionary and the book I've got up here and the lectionary the church is currently using are different. Newer printings of the prayer book have a different lectionary. Lectionary changed three times between 1928 and 1979. and it's just the reality of the way things work. Let's talk about the early principles of revision. This is actually going back to the 16th century, and these are the things that our earliest reformers in the Anglican tradition cared about, that it be deeply rooted in Scripture. Perhaps some of you remember the wonderful moment when a gentleman comes out of church after the Eucharist on a Sunday morning, and the rector standing at the door, and he says, "You know, I just never cease to be amazed at how often the Scriptures quote the prayer book." Now, I thought, now there's a true Episcopalian. You know, he has memorized just a huge percentage of Scripture. But he's memorized that Scripture because he's prayed the canticles, he's prayed the prayers, he's prayed the litanies, all of which, or not all of which, but the majority of which are in some ways paraphrases or liturgical renderings or liturgical uses of the Scripture. It's a heavy-duty scriptural book. Consonant with the teaching of the early church. Now, that's an interesting one, you know, and this is one Gordon and I could probably duel on for a long time because, you know, a lot of the reformers, of whatever their stripe, wanted to have their worship and their life together in the church, their organization of the church as they understood it, consonant with the practice of the ancient church, and yet in the 16th century, the limitation of our knowledge about the ancient church compared to what it is now, and they developed certain principles that sort of they turned out to be wrong about just historically, and that's fine. I mean, the idea to the best of our knowledge align our worship, our organization, our polity, our whatever with the practice of the ancient church is a perfectly fine idea. As long as one recognizes that our understanding of that in the last five centuries has evolved rather dramatically. And I mean, I can still say consonant with the teaching of the ancient church, but what I mean by that is a whole lot different from what, say, William Chillingworth thought in the 16th century. Unifying of the realm. I think that's an important one to remember because the Book of Common Prayer from its very inception was a dramatically political book. It wasn't just about the religion of the Catholic Church in England. It was about unifying the king's realm. It was about holding people together. It was about finding a way that those who were troubled in one fashion or another by the separation of the Catholic Church in England from the papacy. And then all the influence coming over from the continent of evangelical reform of one sort or another, Lutheran, Reformed, so forth. And all these things were, at least in England, were just churning and churning and churning. And part of the task of the book was to be, you know, Catholic enough, evangelical enough, Reformed enough, that people could find a way to stay together and live together. It was part of the goal of the book. It was also part of the genius of the book because that, to a large degree, worked. But, you know, we have a kind of, and at least I will say in the Episcopal Church, and I'll also remember that there was a certain piety toward this in Lutheranism, that, you know, we have this singular book, so you can just sort of go into any Episcopal Church anywhere, and it's the same. Well, that really is a fantasy. I mean, we can all use the same book, but I would argue that that's not a downside. That's actually an upside, because part of the genius of the way the book works in our life together is that, you know, a small little congregation of 10 people in Alaska in January sitting around a potbelly stove and reading the prayers and breaking bread together with their priest, who really can't stand behind an altar because he'd freeze to death. You know, I mean, they really do have to sit around the pot-bellied stove for these rites. And St. Mary the Virgin on Times Square in New York, or a little Carpenter Gothic parish in Iowa, you know, or a big university parish in Sewanee. You know, they're all using the same book. They're all sort of honoring the same tradition. But how that gets worked out in music and ceremonial and space and all these things can be just so dramatically different. Actually, my own observation is the Lutherans are much better than that than Episcopalians are. Because you can go from Lutheran church to Lutheran church to Lutheran church, and while there will be differences because of the building, because of the musical resources, because of a whole variety of things, the use of the ELW would be more like the church down the road than the prayer book would be likely to be more like the church down the road. And it's just an interesting thing to contemplate. But I will say, you know, this sort of notion that, well, and when you have a liturgical book like this, it's the same everywhere. That's largely fantasy. I mean, that's like when people talk about the unified glory of the ancient church. You know, is somehow the ancient church was this unified thing that, well, it wasn't. Language and expression of the people. In other words, the vernacular. You know, I always have to remind my students that, you know, don't ever be unkind to the people who did Latin as their liturgical language, because there was a time when that was the vernacular. I think we have right to be a little more gracious than we often are, because that was their vernacular for a very long time. But we cared a lot about how we talk to God and how we talk to each other. And we wanted it in language that people could understand. First, the Scriptures. That was the first thing in English liturgy that went into English, was the reading of the lessons. And then as time went on, more and more of it became a part of the expression. And, of course, as we think about revision, I know this was a significant conversation in the revision of the ELW, and it's will be again. I mean, we have inclusive language rights in the Episcopal Church, or expansive language rights, I think we would prefer to say, and that whole liturgical language thing will be a big part of the conversation in prayer book revision. I don't worry about that particularly. I mean, sometimes I worry about the result of a particular prayer, and I don't really like that part. But anyway, you know. That we all have our things. But my point here is, caring about the language is among the very first things our tradition, the Anglican tradition, articulated as a virtue of liturgical life together. Yes? Absolutely. And I think... Yeah, and I can speak perhaps more clearly from the Episcopal side. I mean, it's an ongoing. As Anglicans, we're obviously an English-bound church in a fairly dramatic way, and yet we have increasing numbers of Latinos, and in the diocese, I think I'm right about the number. The Sunday Eucharist is celebrated in 43 different languages in the Diocese of Los Angeles. It is in something like 17 different languages in the Diocese of New York, it's a lot more complicated issue than simply translating an English book into Spanish that doesn't pay attention to, and I'm not talking about just linguistic idioms. I'm talking about sort of, you know, theological and other kinds of clarity that a simple translation sometimes won't do. But then you also have when I was the Bishop of the Diocese of Atlanta, one of the things that we struggled with very significantly was, what about communities that live together? We had one congregation, for example, in Northwest Georgia, that and it was not a large congregation. It was probably 60 people whose first language was Spanish, and about the same number of people whose first language was English. And they actually fell in love with each other. And what they started out doing was, you know, 9 o'clock was in Spanish and 11 o'clock was in English or some such, you know. But then they would meet at the coffee hour. And that's where they had their interchange. But they finally yearned for more than that. And so with the help of our missioner and some others in that area, that they finally, I hate the term, but they basically blended the liturgy and did the same rite at both services that was both English and Spanish. And so you had these people, you know, who, you know, lifelong Anglo-Episcopalians who were singing Spanish music and responding to the liturgy in Spanish. And you had these folks who were historically, Latino, learning to do Anglican chant. You know, but they made a commitment to doing it together. Now, a lot of our other Latino and Anglo congregations across the diocese, no, they kept the old pattern. We're going to have a Spanish service and English service, and we'll meet you for vestry meeting. You know, but we're not going to really do anything. We're going to keep the two services pure, whatever that would mean. So, but I think it's a struggle going forward, and I think it's one that, but it's a struggle that we must engage. Everybody, I think, it's to the heart of who we are, at least as Anglicans, and I feel fairly confident it's not an unknown phenomenon among the Lutherans. I mean, that speaking in your own language, praying in your own language, or at least having that honored in some appropriate way in the public rites of the church, is just vitally important. And so moving, and that will be hard for some people. It is hard for some people. But I don't think there's a choice about that. It seems to me that we've got to continue to explore new ways. And I don't even think we've begun to explore that as fully as we need to. I think there are probably theorists of language and language and ritual and so forth that have some gifts to give us some things that we can take seriously as we move this next level of revision. Of course, you know, that's one of the old arguments for, you know, the Latin rite is if everybody in the world does Latin, then it doesn't matter whether you're this, that, or the other. You're all at least liturgically in the same language. Oh, that's an interesting fantasy. But I don't think we're going to sell that in the 21st century. at least I can't imagine. A couple of other things, moving ahead quickly. Our liturgical structures were not wholly new in the 16th century, at least in our two traditions. I mean, we took things that we inherited and worked on, revised them, and enabled them, amplified them, and whatever. But we were not starting with a blank sheet of paper. But we're in some ways, we inherited the structures of the Latin Rite. Such revisions were driven by a variety of things: theological interests, political interests, pastoral interests. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, we could have spent some more time on that, but I want to move along here. The prayer book between E1 and E2. That's Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. Between the Elizabethan settlement and Rayfong Williams, or however you want to put that. And there are basically two families of prayer books in the Anglican tradition. There's the English family of prayer books, and there's the Scottish-American family of prayer books. If you pick up two books of these two traditions and open them up, you're going to see most of the same words, but there will be dramatic differences in certain, or not dramatic differences, there will be subtle differences in certain things that will distinguish the two traditions. And I would say that not the only thing, but the principal thing around that will be related to the Eucharist, which we can get to if we need to. Though both of these traditions share that same classical shape, the same five parts I mentioned earlier, and we share most, as I just said, most of the liturgical texts. But let me just give you an example of how these kinds of things work. If you take, I've lost my prayer book. If you go to Rite 1, I know that will be painful, but for some it will, and for others of us it's close to our heart. But if you go to Rite 1, page 337, Here's an example that's kind of interesting. The prayer at the bottom of 337 is what we refer to as the prayer of humble access. We do not presume to come to this thy table, O merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness and thy manifold and great mercies. We are not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under thy table, but thou art saying, Lord, his property is always mercy granted us. Therefore, gracious Lord, so to eat the flesh and of thy dear Son Jesus Christ and drink his blood, that we may evermore dwell in him. Now, I'm emphasizing that for a reason, right? One of the interesting things about the history of the prayer book tradition is you follow through the prayer books and figure out where they put the prayer of humble access. If the prayer of humble access is up back toward the offertory, is a preparatory prayer prior to the actual celebration of the Eucharist, in most cases you can assume that at that particular time of prayer book revision the Puritans were winning the arguments. Because they wanted to keep the prayer, but they wanted to put it in a place where people could not interpret it realistically, or more literally, if you will. At another time, however, they revised the prayer book, and they would put it after the consecration, the point being to interpret with those words the theology of the Episcopal side. I usually distinguish between Episcopalians and Puritans. There's other terminology. Those are just the easiest big catches. In these various movements, you know, you'll often, people will look and say, well, it's the same text I know. But what they're not paying attention to is how the text has been very carefully reordered to make different theological points at different times in the history. So the fact that we share most of the text doesn't mean that we're always using the text exactly the same way. Now, everybody in the room understands that if you've studied the Synoptic Gospels, right? Yeah. Matthew tells the same story that Luke does, but for a slightly different purpose. And therefore, it shades the meaning of that part of the Jesus story. Okay. We reshape structure according to theological emphases. That's what I just said. Okay. I'm getting ahead of myself here. One of the things that the prayer book tradition, I think, is true is between Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II, we largely resist the introduction of new material. There's more material in my hand, new material, in my hand now, than any of my predecessors could have argued for prior to this particular book. That doesn't mean there wasn't a new formulation, a new prayer here or there in 1892 or 1928. There were a few. But it was largely an issue of resistance. Revision was largely tinkering and rarely substantive. And it was the kind of tinkering I was talking about when saying, okay, you know, the winds of Eucharistic theology have shifted. So what we need to do is not take out the prayer of humble access, but we need to move it to a stronger position if we're arguing for this, or a weaker position if we're arguing for that, or whatever. But the prayer itself wasn't going to go away. And now, the next time period is Pio Nono to Johnny Unitas. If you're from Macon, Georgia, which is in the Diocese of Atlanta, one of the main streets of town is Pio Nono Boulevard. But it's Panono, yeah. It's not Pio Nono. You're a Maconite, say it. Pio Nono, right, exactly. And Johnny Unitas, of course, is John the 23rd. Okay? there you go. Yeah. Okay. Johnny Unitas reference there is actually for students of the Southern Seminary of the ELCA who study with Ben Biedenbaugh. Just so you know. Okay. Anyway, from the mid-19th century, there was an extraordinary ferment going on. Ferment was the order of the day politically, theologically, economically. People sometimes, you know, in a cocktail conversation say, you know, if you could live in another period, when would you like to live? And I've got several because I want to talk to certain people. but part of me would really love to have lived in the second half of the 19th century, it was a terrible time to be alive in some ways. But in other ways, it must have been just so fabulously crazy that it would appeal to all of my interesting instincts. What was going on theologically, politically, economically, and the dialogue partners with what was going on in the church in places were things like rationalism, nationalism, liberalism, romanticism. Romanticism was particularly something across the channel in England that we just couldn't quite get enough of. We were just taken with our romantic desires. Okay, everything vacillated between fear and insecurity over change and excitement. Insecurity over change versus excitement, creativity, new horizons, and learnings, discoveries. Now think about that, the second half of the 19th century. Think about the negative dimensions, the hard dimensions, the difficult times that represented on one side, but then think of the discoveries, think of the new learnings, think of the academic progress, the scientific progress. I mean, the dialogue that was going on in that time was just, it would blow you away. And of course, if the church is in the middle of all that, and is in the middle of that culture, in the middle of that context, it's going to have that kind of effect on us. And of course, at least for those Anglicans in British Isles, it certainly did, and I don't have any reason to think that that's different anywhere else. There were rumblings at this time among Roman Catholics, particularly Benedictines, though not limited to Benedictines by any means, but they're just, I do think they're notable in all this, who began to pursue liturgical research for the sake of liturgical renewal. One thing that I used to just drive me crazy in graduate school, you know, you would read fabulous research done by Benedictine monks in the second half of the 19th century, and they would write these wonderful treatises on ancient liturgical texts or on some liturgical theological whatever, and they would lead you like a horse to water through all this extraordinary stuff, and then right at the end would say, "But Holy Mother Church teaches that." In other words, they were laying all the groundwork for a kind of freedom of thinking and a freedom of exploration and an openness that was just rather extraordinary, that it took another 50 or 60 years closer to the council for that to really kind of blossom and flourish. But if you go back and read those texts and work with those texts and spend time with those texts, you know, you can see the springtime. You can see the buds beginning to shape, you know, and even though they can't be in full bloom for another 50, 70, 100 years, depending on how you divide the period up, it was just really exciting. Rumblings among Anglicans grew out of the ecclesiological interests of the Oxford movement, the ritualist movements like Cambridge Camden, the Henry Bradshaw Society, which of course was about providing critical editions of the time of significant liturgical texts, and even renewed interest in the Parker Society. Parker Society books, of course, were dealing principally with Reformation texts, but even looking at Reformation texts through 19th century eyes with a kind of a new flavor became an interesting exercise that had great impact on these liturgical matters. And Camden, they were largely a group that were interested in art and architecture and how the history of art and architecture, particularly in the medieval period, but in other they're the ones that had a lot to say about what in our tradition and to some degree in the Lutheran tradition became the sort of Gothic revival of the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, where we had this sort of idea that a real church needs to be made of stone and has to look like such and such and, you know, whatever. For better or for worse, they were a group of the theorists. And then in the Lutheran tradition, you had similar movements as represented by the St. James Society. If those of you who are kind of, Gordon may kill me for this, but liturgical, sacristy rats, in the Lutheran tradition, the St. James Society is long defunct. But in any of the good Lutheran libraries, you'll still find the annuals of the St. James Society, and it is fascinating reading. when you get people like Henry Eisner Jacobs and Paul Zeller Strobach and Luther Dottore Reed and Edward Trailhorn and all these guys who are part of all that, writing and some of them were trying so hard to stay Lutheran, and others wanted to kind of push the envelope and be more evangelical Catholics of a more ecumenical sort, and then they would reel themselves back in. And I mean, it was just fascinating reading, just absolutely fascinating reading. And those whole documents. I've already been through the list of names, and so there you have it. But this fermentation, it seems to me, results in four common themes. One is the recovery and centrality of holy baptism, the recovery and revision of the rites of Christian initiation. I will say without any qualification, and you'll never change my mind even if you prove I'm wrong. I think when we get enough distance on it, and there's already some historians working on this, but I think when we get enough distance on it, the church historians will say that the principal story of the second half of the 20th century in the life of the Christian church is sort of reasserting the centrality of holy baptism and making it central to our life, not only liturgically, but our life, our identity, our spiritual life. It kind of that around which everything else orbits. I think from the middle of the 20th century to the present, the shift between SBH and LBW, the shift between 28 and 79 in the prayer book. I mean, all of that you can't observe that without getting wet. It's just all over the place. Okay, the reassertion of Sunday celebration of the Eucharist is the principal liturgy of the Lord's Day. Again, we're two traditions that from the very beginning would have asserted confessionally or in other ways what do Christians do on Sunday? They celebrate the Eucharist. Well, we all know our respective histories, where for a significant part of our history in both of our traditions, the primacy of the Lord's Day and the celebration of the Eucharist on the Lord's Day was not, in fact, what we did. It's back to my earlier distinction between what is normative, what we would say about ourselves, and what is, in fact, normal. And, of course, the same is true of the Calvinists, as certain other parts of the Reformed tradition, certainly the Wesleyan tradition, and so forth. So this is one of my Wesleyan friends, Russ Ritchie, who's a Wesley scholar. He heard me say something like that in a lecture one day, and he raised his hand, and he said, "Well, Neil, the Methodists, you're right. We've always believed in weekly communion, but at least in American Methodism, we have an excuse because we had circuit riding preachers, and we insisted that the person presiding had to be ordained, and they couldn't get there but every 6 weeks." And he said, "But you had an ordained minister in every parish, and you had no excuse." I said, "Okay, all right." All right. Revision of lectionaries in a common direction with a move from 1 to 3 year cycle is the norm. I don't want to take a whole lot more time with this, but I just got to tell you a story. I was kind of curious. If you want to do something really fun, I had to do a project several years ago that was essentially delving into a little bit of the history of American theological education. And one of the things I discovered that it was kind of like, duh, surely I should have known that, but I didn't, was if you go back to the late 1950s, to the 1940s, and look at a catalog from the Virginia Seminary, Suwannee, General, I checked schools of various denominations, liturgical denominations, and it was interesting that most of them had a required New Testament course in the Gospel of Matthew. And if they taught Mark or Luke at all, they were electives. Now, why do you reckon that was? Because we had a one-year lectionary that was almost entirely Matthew, with a few glasses in John here, and the occasional, they'd get, you know, one passage from Luke or something for the Feast of the Presentation or whatever. But, I mean, the Sunday morning readings were heavily Matthew. Now to think about that another way, just, I don't want to get off the topic here, but once we got moved from one-year lectionary to three-year lectionary, so we had three Gospels going, and for the first time in centuries, the church was regularly hearing Luke. Is it any wonder that certain air has blown through the church in the last 60 years that maybe didn't blow before? Because Luke's got a really different take on some of this. You know, I'm always more comfortable in year C than I am. Give me B or C. And it's simply because I kind of connect with Mark and Luke. And I always had to kind of, you know, grip my teeth through Matthew. And that says more about me than it does the lectionary. But, you know, you know, you can't open your mouth without being self-revelatory. So there it was, you know. Okay. And finally, the revision and enrichment of daily prayer, which we'll not talk about now. Now, the consensus of this, what's happening here, though, it seems to me, is there is, I mean, all these Roman Catholics, these Lutherans, these various societies, these Anglicans, and some of our sisters and brothers in other places, we're all moving in kind of this consensus direction. And the one of the first times you see a manifestation of that, and by no means is this perfect consensus, and we're not talking about every detail being the same, but we're talking about the spirit of the age kind of coming together. And the first time it seems to me you see that is in the Common Service, the Lutheran Common Service of 1888, which is followed almost immediately, and of course that works itself out in the Common Service book at another level in 1817. And then just 4 years later, the Book of Common Prayer, 1892, And that's the first of the prayer books where you begin to get a little bit of, shall we say, liturgical fermentation. This fermentation is beginning to rise up. And then after 1817, then we turn right around in 1928. Now let me tell you, this is a story that even some of the Episcopalians may not be aware of. You know, our ecclesial life at the General Convention level has been nothing but difficult. In maybe the last decade, but as a historian, I would tell you that we haven't been through anything like the 1925 General Convention. If you go back and read the journals, read the documents, read the stuff, the 1925 General Convention was the closest the Episcopal Church has ever come to breaking up. What did it break up over? The prayer book. If it's the 1928 prayer book, it gets its first reading at what convention? 1925. Okay? And this whole kind of fermentation that I've been talking about, with the Common Service, with the, you know, Benedictine research, with these various liturgical societies and these various conversations, all this stuff that's bubbling to the surface during this time, there was a group in the Episcopal Church that wanted real revision, wanted to begin to completely reshape our thinking about a variety of things. And proposed all manner of changes to the prayer book, all of which, that's close enough. All of which, the convention just said, no, we're not going to go there. But it created such a ruckus and such division that the way the convention got through it was to say, okay, if we will approve the essentially non-revision 28 prayer book. But in return for that, we get a standing liturgical commission whose canonical responsibility is always to keep liturgical revision and renewal before the church and to constantly be working on that. And so the liturgical commission was created, went to work immediately, and it's interesting how much of this book had precursors, was anticipated in some of the recommended reforms of 1928, but the church just wasn't ready to go there yet. But what we did get out of that convention was the mechanism to go forward. Another little factoid, on the first Sunday in Advent 1976, more parishes of the Episcopal Church used this book than ever used the 1928 prayer book. The other thing that some of you who remember the 1928 prayer book in those years well will remember is that the difference between what went on in a parish church and what was in the book that was in the pew rack was as different sometimes as night as was from day. That was Father Mulcahy's take on the prayer book. And so when people started saying, you know, I can't believe they're taking my liturgy away from me, and they'll say, well, this, what you're doing is not in the prayer book anyway. Never was in the prayer book, you know, because there were lots and lots of local rites of their own creation, and everybody in the congregation thought that was in the prayer book. And a lot of the words were the same, but it really wasn't the same rite. Oh, yeah, I can give you two examples off the top of my head. One is gabbing. And before the 1979 prayer book, you could even look in the phone book and it would say St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, and then it would be parentheses underneath the name of the church and the yellow pages would say Gab. Well, in the 1928 prayer book, the Gloria in Excelsis was at the end of the service as the kind of final hymn of praise at the end of the liturgy. Gab means Gloria at the beginning. And so, I mean it was a whole movement in the church of gabbing parishes, we used to call them. You know, does your parish gab? You know, yeah. And that was one. and then various changes of name. Another one was great division in the Episcopal Church between 28 and 79 about how you deal with ablutions and consuming bread and wine at the end and where you do that. Do you do it at the altar? Do you do it at the credence? And those who did it at the altar, as the Romans do, were called tarpers. Yeah, which was to say, and what tarp meant was take ablutions Roman position, as opposed to the historic Anglican position, which is at the credence or after the public liturgy is over, it is reverently managed by the curate, the assistants, the altar guild, whomever. And so when you have advertisements, you know we are gabbers and tarpers, it's crazy, but I love it. The next piece of that, of course, is a service book and hymnal, which Gordon may have a slightly different interpretation of this, but it seems to me where the whole common service tradition sort of comes to its fullness is in the service book and hymnal of 1958. That was the reigning book when I was ordained. And that says the same thing, doesn't it? Okay. Moving on really quickly here. Then comes the Second Vatican Council, and is a Methodist bishop I used to know, used to say, he said, you know, when something as big as Rome moves, even if we have no need to be obedient, no desire to be obedient, whatever, when they move, we all have to pay attention. Because it's going to have impact upon us, whether we want it to or not. Okay? And so there are several documents here that get into this conversation. I'm going to go ahead and put them all up here, and how important these are. First is the Missal of Paul VI in 1969. That's the Roman Missal revision, first revision since the Council of Trent, right after the Second Vatican Council. And then Ordo Lectionem Missae in 1969, which is the Roman three-year lectionary, of which the old prayer book lectionary and the whole three-year idea of the Synoptic Gospels and John mixed in around Easter and all that kind of stuff and the relationship between the Gospel and the Old Testament reading and all those kinds of things were essentially launched. And Ordo Lectionem Missae and most of the ecumenical lectionaries then took their cue from that and were either slight or somewhat more significant revisions, at least of the idea. Later on, when we get to the Common Lectionary in this country and the RCL, we begin to put other theological pieces in motion that are a little fuller. I won't go into all that right now. And then, of course, the renewal of Christian initiation in the Roman Church, the renewal of the catechumenate, holy baptism, Easter vigil, all those kinds of things that come out in the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults in 1972. And so much of the liturgical revision of the Lutherans and the Episcopate, not that we have copied them, not that we have mimicked them in any case, but with the fullness of those rites and the kind of theological conversation that went on around that, and us having walked for the last century in this same sort of soup, then these became, you know, again, not documents to be copied. I mean, theologically, we'd have some issues and whatever, but they kind of established the conversation at a certain level that the rest of us are going to work out in our peculiarly Lutheran or Anglican ways. There's some others. And so I would argue that these matters then, this whole century from the middle of the 19th century through the beginnings of the Roman fermentation, the Lutheran fermentation, the Anglican fermentation, and there was a lot of conversation back and forth, some public, a lot of it not public, you know, a lot of mutual influences back and forth. You know, one of the some parts of it in our contemporary liturgical renewal sensitivities will drive you crazy, but if you really want to see a sense of the relationship between Episcopalians and Lutherans on these, you know, spending, and I'm not sure I'd read it cover to cover anymore, but spending a few hours wallowing around in Luther Reed's book called Worship : Corporate Devotion is really his apologia for the way Anglicans and Lutherans have helped each other through those early decades of liturgical reform in the early part of the 20th century. It's an interesting read. I mean, some of them curl your hair now, as it should, because we've moved on past certain things. But you know, just as a historical moment in time, it's a very valuable kind of bit of a read. But anyway, I would argue that all that fermentation then first comes to its kind of fruition in LBW of 78, the Book of Common Prayer 79. And so what are the gifts of convergence? And I'm almost done. Well, maybe. Ah, there we are. And I think one of the gifts in all this is, and I'm talking Eucharistically principally here, is there is, I think, a common ordo. I didn't say identical ordo. There are an interesting number of similar ritual structures while maintaining tradition-bound details. And what do I mean by that? I'll just give you I was talking to Gordon yesterday, and as a former Lutheran pastor, but who has now been an Episcopalian for 34 years or something, I don't know, something like that. It's hardly a day that goes, a Eucharist that goes by. The thing I miss the most is the hymn of the day. The De Tempore hymn following the sermon before the Nicene Creed, where the people stand up and respond to the proclamation and preaching of the gospel and proclaim it themselves in the singing of that hymn. That's what I mean by a tradition-bound detail, though. I don't suspect we'll ever talk the Episcopal Church into a hymn of the day at that place. I mean, that's just more instinct than data. But I just don't think we will. but we do have similar ritual structures. You know, we recognize each other when we're in each other's liturgies. Okay, that's really all that means. And commitment to the primacy of Sunday. And not just the celebration of the Eucharist on the Lord's Day, but the primacy of Sunday. That the principal holy day of the Christian tradition is not Easter. It is Sunday. Week in and week out, week in and week out for a lifetime. You know, it's kind of, you know, Sunday school triteness, but it's still true. You know, it drives me crazy when somebody says to me, well, you know, or says in my presence, you know, well, every Sunday is a little Easter. No, that's backwards. Every Sunday is not a little Easter. Every single Sunday is the feast of the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. And because of the collision of the weekly cycle and the annual cycle, Easter Day is a really, really big Sunday. But it's not the other way around. The principal feast of Christian life is Sunday. Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. And all these annual and, you know, seasonal and annual and other kinds of collisions of calendars and whatever make for great liturgy and great thinking about the life of the church and the story of our faith and all that kind of stuff. But it's part of it's our Jewish inheritance. Jews have essentially a liturgical year. But ask any Jew that practices, what is the rhythm of your holy life? It's a Sabbath rhythm. And for us, it's a Sunday rhythm. Week in and week out, week in and week out. And all this other stuff is details. Commitment to the centrality of holy baptism, we've talked about that. Commitment to a sacramental view of preaching, and this is almost where I'm going to stop, but I want to tell a story about Gordon. Gordon's good work and friendship has meant so much to me over the years, and his teaching has taught me a lot. But no time better. I was representing the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada way back when, in the very first iteration of the Revised Common Lectionary, and Gordon was representing, I guess, the then LCA, maybe one of them. One of those batches of initials in our former life. He was representing the U.S. Lutherans, and I was representing the Canadian Lutherans, and all of our Anglican and Episcopalian and Reformed and Methodist and Catholic friends were all there, and we were in this dreadful, dreadful room, conference room, at the Holiday Inn in Des Plaines, Illinois, and every 45 seconds we had to kind of stop the conversation so a plane could go over. It landed O'Hare. But anyway, we were in the process at that particular meeting of we all knew that the sort of manner of choosing readings to go with the 3-year cycle of Gospels and how to do the course readings of the second readings and how to there's a particular way of doing that the Roman lectionary had done of prophecy fulfillment or real connectivity, textual connectivity and whatever with the with the first reading, the Old Testament reading. And we thought, well, that's fine, except that there are other ways to think about that. And we were trying to sort out the other ways to think about that. Yeah, and this is an ecumenical group. And in the session right after lunch, it got really, really testy. And really, it's about as testy. Of course, you can imagine sitting around fighting about the lectionary. That's testy among people of your own tradition. And when you're there with a group of other people, it gets even testier. And so the room got really, really uncomfortable. And so Paul Gibson from the Anglican Church of Canada was our moderator at the time, and he called for a break. And he went over in the corner of a few people and tried to figure out what to go. And he came back, when we all came back together, he said, I'd like to ask Dr. Lathrop if he would fill some time here and talk to us about some of this. And Gordon, with an eloquence that was just spirit-filled for the moment, said, well, the reason we're having this problem is because the Lutherans and the Anglicans and some of us from those kinds of traditions, we have a shall we say, sacramental view of preaching. And those of you from the Reformed tradition and some of these other traditions represented in the room really have a different task before you when you stand up and preach. And he went on to very carefully say, he said, if you're the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church, and you got this lectionary, you want first and second readings to help you preach the text. Those of us in sacramental traditions want first and second readings to help us preach Jesus. Because we want to give the people Jesus in the preaching just as powerfully, just as sacramentally, as we give Jesus to the people in the sacrament of the altar. And at that point, the whole room exhaled and said, right. We are preaching to different tasks here. The lessons are important in both cases. breaking the word is powerful and necessary in both cases. But it's really we're doing it to a different end. One is lifting up insights into the scriptural word. Other is helping us fall in love with the living word. Well, sisters and brothers, that was a life-changing moment for yours truly, for which I have been deeply grateful to my brother Gordon for lo these many years. And I've told that story, as I told him last night, all over the world. Commitment to the renewal of daily prayer and devotion. And finally, moving toward each other is good for both of us, I believe, because both traditions have a high view of Holy Scripture, but when it comes to theological reflection, Lutherans begin with theological reflection, particularly as guided by the confessions, and shape the liturgy as an expression of those reflections, whereas Episcopalians are more likely to begin with their liturgies and prayers and see their liturgical texts as the starting place for theological reflection. And while these tendencies are not to be ignored, they are not mutually exclusive and are richly ambiguous. Those two things are gifts to the other. I believe that our gifts in that area are gifts that we need to graciously give to the Lutherans, and the gifts of theological reflection that find expression in liturgical life is a gift that the Lutherans need to be bold about giving to us. And that, I believe, has brought this conversation full circle. Thank you. Gordon?